Human rights and civil societies in Latin America, next on Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Diplomat and activist Patricia Darien is here to talk about human rights in Latin America. Before that, Robert Connor, director of the National Humanities Center, will be here to discuss Latin America and the idea of a civil society.
Military regimes have been such a horrible problem in Latin America that there's a natural tendency to think of civil society simply as the absence of a military regime. And I think one of the things we were able to do in our recent conference here is to focus thinking a little bit, in effect, on a more positive way of thinking about it. That is, you don't guarantee human rights simply by eliminating military regimes. I think what you need are these strong, vital institutions that sort of buffer the...
Robert Connor, director of the National Humanities Center. He'll be back in just a moment to talk about human rights and civil societies in Latin America. Support for this edition of Soundings comes from the Rockefeller Foundation. Additional funding comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities, the A.J. Fletcher Foundation, and Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Against the recent backdrop of an astonishing series of political developments, illustrated in the collapse of Soviet communism and in struggles elsewhere around the globe to establish democratic institutions, scholars are coming afresh to explore the relationship between the citizen and the state. Much of this new thinking is evoked in the idea of a civil society, that space between the individual and the state occupied by voluntary and non-governmental groups, trade unions, commercial associations, and human rights agencies. Under the direction of Robert Connor, the National Humanities Center has recently sponsored several conferences that examine the idea of a civil society. The most recent of these meetings focused on Latin America. I asked Robert Connor to reflect on the task of defining and encouraging the idea of a civil society in that part of the world.
Well, that's part of the strength of it. It's difficult because they're a very diverse group of organizations, and everybody likes some and doesn't like some others. I mean, they include trade unions and they include manufacturers' organizations. Your sympathies are probably one end or the other. But what we've been trying to do is step out and take a look at the whole basket. And I think in societies where that basket is strong and full, there's a vitality and there's a health that shows itself in various ways, including the strength of human rights in the society. And when that basket's empty, you've got problems.
Let's talk about human rights specifically. Is there a necessary sort of causal connection between the idea of a civil society and a productive, flourishing society that nurtures and strengthens human rights?
Well, we've had plenty of arguments about that, as you can imagine, Wayne, but my own view is a pretty strong yes, that in fact, I think we've often misconceptualized the way in which we get at human rights, and I'm an outside observer on this, but my hunch is that that's probably especially the case in Latin America.
What about military regimes? I mean, to get as specific as possible, we could talk about Argentina in the mid-70s through the mid-80s. We could talk about, even as we're recording this conversation, in Guatemala, President Serrano has basically overthrown the government. You've got a spotty record of human rights in Salvador. Again, because there is an absence of military regimes, do we have a flourishing of human rights?
Well, you see, I think that's part of the problem, that there's military regimes have been such a horrible problem in Latin America that there's a natural tendency to think of civil society simply as the absence of a military regime. And I think one of the things we were able to do in our recent conference here is to focus thinking a little bit in effect, on a more positive way of thinking about it. That is, you don't guarantee human rights simply by eliminating military regimes. I think what you need are these strong, vital institutions that sort of buffer the relationship between the individual and the state. They help shape state policy on the one side, they influence it, they lobby it, they pressure it on the one side, and they also provide certain autonomy for individuals and ask them to take responsibility for certain things on their own.
You have pointed out, Bob Connor, that in Mexico there has been a remarkable flourishing between 1980 and here we are in the, you know, what, mid-1993. Back 13 years ago, there was virtually no activity about human rights in Mexico, and now there are, what, you said hundreds of organizations?
Well, I picked this up from Sergio Aguayo, who is one of our speakers at this conference, been a very strong voice for human rights in Mexico, and he pointed out precisely that growth in a decade from virtually zero to well over 200 organizations, and they seem to be strong, vital organizations. They relate to each other in imaginative, correlated ways. And I think they're having a transforming effect in Mexico, and Mexico in some ways seems to me then to provide a model for other parts of the world.
Uh-huh. One of the people who's been involved in our activity and the Humanity Center's activities about the idea of a civil society and human rights specifically in Latin America is Eduardo Rabosi, who was a legal philosopher from the University of Buenos Aires. Reflect for me on the kind of work that somebody like Eduardo does, that is to say, with legal systems, giving this idea of civil societies and the nurturing of human rights a legal framework in which to operate.
Well, that comes out, as you know, but maybe not all listeners to the show know, Wayne, out of a human experience. I mean, Eduardo was the person whom the Alfonsín government in Argentina asked to look into what had happened to these disappeared, and look in it not just in a factual way, but to look into it to see what could be done to prevent any recurrence of such a horror.
Mm-hmm.
Eduardo seems to me to be somebody who is a scholar, a philosopher, who's had that overwhelming experience of looking into the pit of hell.
Uh-huh.
And has come out of that, I think. He's a remarkably optimistic person. I think he sees that in the resurgence of democratic rule, in parts at least of Latin America, and in the growth of civil society, something that lends some grounds for optimism that we can avoid the kind of horrors that have happened so often in that part of the world.
Yeah, he refers to it, what, on being sane in the midst of madmen, people. Bob, what is the responsibility of the academics when we explore and explain to ourselves the idea of a civil society? I mean, on the one hand, we can say that you've got political activists, you've got the politicians, another category. Then you've got these people who think this problem through. What really is their responsibility?
Well, I think that's another case of a lot of different people doing a lot of different things. I wouldn't want to just narrow it down too precisely. But I think where intellectuals and scholars can really make a difference is not so much in telling people what specific policies they've got to put in place and trying to tell people in Argentina or Paraguay what they should be doing, but rather in trying to set the context within which we can think about these problems. That's where I think the idea of a civil society is so important, and why some of our work has been able, I hope, to be helpful in thinking about types of approaches that might really work.
Now, academics are traditionally, where the first thing you learn in freshman English is watch out for those wild generalizations, but here we go. Academics traditionally associate themselves with the left. Do we therefore assume that the idea of a civil society in partisan terms is always going to be a, quote, liberal kind of thing that's happening?
Well, liberal not necessarily in U.S. terminology. You're talking to a classicist, Wayne, and so I turn etymological at every point. Liberal in the sense of being concerned with human freedom?
Uh-huh.
Absolutely. Uh-huh. And I think that's a tremendously important thing. Liberal in the sense of a specific set of social and economic policies that work in the United States. No, I think there's no necessary correlation there.
Bob Connor, let's move toward a conclusion of our conversation. We're about to listen to Pat Darien, a former diplomat, a writer, a human rights activist, reflect on civil societies and human rights in Latin America. What's the responsibility of the United States of America? There's a big order. I mean, we've got a spotty record when it comes to human rights and nurturing them in Latin America, but are there particular notions, responsibilities that we should be aware of?
Well, let me answer with an anecdote, if I can, Wayne. I was standing at the reception talking to a couple of our participants from Latin America when your guest, Pat Derian, walked in. And one, they were both Argentines, turned to the other and said, "That's Pat Derian. You know, I'm here alive today because of what she did when she was Undersecretary for State for Human Rights in the Carter administration and came down to Argentina during the time when torture and repression was so widespread." Then the other speaker turned and just nodded and said, "You know, I think that's probably true for me, too." In other words, what came through to me in this was not some profound generalization or policy statement or anything, but a sense of the tremendous leadership role that the United States has in this part of the world, as so many others, and that whatever differences, whatever strength of nationalism and concerns people have, they look to us for leadership.
Bob Connor, I want to thank you for your reflections on the idea of a civil society, the work of the National Humanities Center with respect to civil societies and human rights, particularly with regard to Latin America. You've just come from a conference there. Bob, you are the director of the National Humanities Center, a classic scholar and a radio connoisseur. Thanks for coming by to be on Soundings.
Thank you, Wayne. Thanks very much.
It's Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. This is Wayne Pond. Human rights and civil societies in Latin America. Join me now for a conversation with diplomat and activist Patricia Derian.
It's like the rest of the world. That is, everything that was has been turned upside down. The nice thing about Latin America is that in many parts, in the parts that have moved to functioning democracies, there is a very positive, affirmative effort to have a civil society, which is what we've been talking about at this conference. Now, you still have Guatemala, and you have big problems in Honduras, and I'm not one of the people who believes that Salvador has had a...
Diplomat and human rights activist Patricia Derian. She spoke at a recent conference convened by the National Humanities Center and devoted to exploring the idea of a civil society in Latin America. In the words of one participant, the civil society is the space between the absolute power of the state on the one hand and the rights and freedom of the individual on the other. In practical terms, civil societies also provide a framework for overcoming divergent geographical and ideological barriers that shape economic decisions and the role of the state. Patricia Derian served as Assistant Secretary of State for Human Rights and Humanitarian Affairs in Latin America under President Jimmy Carter. She's an activist on behalf of strengthening human rights and serves on the boards of America's Watch and the Fund for Free Expression. I asked Patricia Derian to reflect on the idea of a civil society and the prospects for human rights in Latin America today.
If you think that whenever you build something, you build it with bricks and mortar,
mm-hmm.
And need a foundation, the foundation for the civil society is the whole concept of human rights. There was a period, and there are people who think that this is a European notion and that it will not translate. Jean Kirkpatrick, for instance, said some years ago, before she became a big human rights advocate, which she has become in the last few months, when talking about Salvador, she said, you don't have to worry about that. Salvadorans are used to rough treatment. And now I consider that Western arrogance, that somehow we are such sensitive flowers that we don't want to be tortured or mm-hmm. summarily executed or held in jail without charges, but that people in other places are accustomed to that.
Whose responsibility is it to convey, to support, to nurture the idea of human rights and their connection to what we call the civil society? Is it the politicians, the parents, the educators? How does something as difficult as that work?
Technically, you know, it's in the law. It's in international law, and it's really included in almost every every constitution of every country in very specific terms, even though a lot of those constitutions are nailed on the wall and never seem to hook up with how the place is governed. But technically, these are laws that people must obey, and mm-hmm. states are required to obey them. So they are at the top of the list. Knowing how states operate, though, it really depends on non-governmental organizations and individual citizens who go before the court and say, I have been deprived of my rights.
Now, a moment ago, you warned us, Pat Darien, about being arrogant. You know, that is to say, we're the top of the heap, and we can self-righteously pronounce about things like human rights and civil societies. How does the United States function as a model, to the degree that it can, for human rights and the development of civil societies in Latin America?
Ah, in Latin America. I was going to say that internally, while we're always having problems.
Yeah, we got our own problems. Sure.
But we do have ways and means to solve them. Mm-hmm. We have access to the tools in this country. In Latin America, I think we have a very spotty history. Salvador would be a wonderful example, where we poured so much money into the military, piously saying that we had to buy off the military so that the civilian democratically elected president would not be overwhelmed, and we have left a path of carnage there in all these years. In Argentina, for instance, when the junta came in, just when I went to the State Department early in 77, the Latin American Bureau at the State Department really felt that if I went down and talked to the junta members, I would understand the terrible problems they faced.
Let's pause on that for a moment. I've heard a couple of stories about this confrontation that occurred between you and some of these military types. Can you summarize that for me quickly? You sat in a building and you said, I know what's going on in this building. And the reaction was what? Describe it.
Well, actually, we had a lot of meetings like that. And what happened there is what happened in every place I went and talked to the dictators. And that is, they first place their hands on their hearts and say, I'm a father. They name their religion. They name their family and usually their profession. I don't do this. I'm not responsible for this. Nothing like that happened here.
And what did you say?
And then I say what I know about what happens there. So they back off a little, and the next thing they say is, our way of life was threatened, which is a haunting thing for a Mississippian to hear, as we had a lot of way of life threatening during and before the civil rights movements uh-huh. there. But eventually, if you have enough information and you don't attack them personally, when you're just talking to them very coldly and matter-of-factly about what it is they're doing and that you know they're doing it, then they blame it on the lower level.
Mm-hmm. Did the fact that you were a woman make any difference here? I think
it helped, because they're not used to dealing with women generally. So it's also very tension-inducing. So I used being a woman often. I was smoking in those days. And whenever my aim was to keep people talking and not get mad and leave the room, but to say everything and to get it on the record and to continue the discourse. So every now and then, I'd either say something truly aberrant, for instance, in a coffee-drinking country, that I would like a Coca-Cola. That stopped everything, and that gives everybody time to cool down.
Mm-hmm.
And then if I took a cigarette out, 12 men would stand up with their Zippo lighters. So there were lots of little techniques that might not have happened to men. But mainly, it was a little... Do you remember Oriana Fallaci?
The writer.
Right. And uh-huh. the great interviewer who got Henry Kissinger to say that he was having a high noon confrontation. Men saying the strangest things. I used to wonder why they talked to her. And then I got wondering why dictators talk to me. I think part of it is very macho. Well, he may have made a fool of himself. I can handle this. It's uh-huh. a very gripping kind of thing. So being a woman was a distinct advantage.
There's your point of entry. Let's talk about human rights in Latin America and what we're calling the development of civil societies in terms of ordinary citizens. How do we get a grip on that, Pat Darien? I mean, do the people of, you know, if we were to take a man on the street, person on the street poll, Mexico City, La Paz, Buenos Aires, are people aware of this issue as an issue? How do we make them aware of it?
Actually, that came up in the conference yesterday. and it was extremely interesting. Someone made the point, which I think is exactly valid, that if you poll on human rights standards, people almost seem disinterested. But if you talk to them about specific human rights violations, they are very clear, and is almost 100%. There are no people who wish to be tortured or have someone in their family disappeared. And there is a great groundswell of potential outrage when things like this happen. And because of the history in Latin America over these last 30 years, when people were very frightened of saying anything in the beginning, now you get people who come together, form non-governmental organizations, human rights groups, and Mexico is a wonderful example, because it's only been in the last 10 years that anybody could be identified as a human rights person in Mexico, and really in the last 4 years that human rights leaders have made themselves known publicly.
Is the leadership going to come from the politicians? Should we be cynical and say, of course not, it has to come from the, what we, again, are calling the civil society, these sort of places in between the formalities of law and government. Can we look to the politicians and hope for leadership on this?
Well, what you do with politicians when you want something is you push them. And that's part of the civil society, that the people in the society have access and that they have the confidence to step forward and ask and require and say, this is what we want. And mm-hmm. politicians move when pressed.
Is there a model that you could point to, Pat Darien? I mean, as we look at human rights and civil societies in Latin America, I don't want to put you on the spot. I guess I do. What country would you point to and say, here's where the good things are happening?
Well, I could point to several countries where good things have happened, and Argentina would be one, where they finally had an election and threw out their military government, which had seized power, and then had a free election and elected someone. And the next step that impressed me there was that then they had trials of the junta members, and they were convicted and sentenced to jail. Now, Alfonsín, who was the first mm-hmm. freely elected president, when pressed by the military, kind of lost his nerve, I think, and he just made an error that was understandable because what his administration had done had never been done in Latin America before. It was sort of shut the door, pretend it didn't happen, let them go away and be free, let them take the money they stole. He really introduced the idea of the rule of law for governors as well as the governor, and he let them out. And I think everyone concedes, that, except those who were let out, mm-hmm. that was an error. In Brazil, they've made a great deal of progress, but it's very itchy there because the economy was so bad because the military absolutely raped the economy and turned over to the civilians a place with practically no capital and a massive debt. And that's one of the big handicaps for all of the Latin American countries. And the thing that makes possible all of the things you were talking about and that makes possible the civil society, in my own view, is that you have to have some concept of who we are as a people.
Mm-hmm.
And you miss that. And even though the countries are very nationalistic, nationalism is like a coat of paint. And if you've painted it over a piece of paper, it's not the same thing as painting it over a brick wall.
Why does it work in North America, in the United States and Canada? That is to say, to the degree, again, that it does work, as we strive for civil polity and unity, and of course we have our cultural diversities, and of course we have our political differences. But again, help me to figure this out. Why is it working here in North America, and it hasn't worked so well in Latin America?
Well, in almost every Latin American country I've gone to, people have asked that, particularly leaders. How come you're doing so well and we're in this terrible spot?
Is it because we're capitalism? What kind of words do we use to figure this out?
I don't know the fact. I don't know the real thing. But mm-hmm. but what I developed as an answer is what I believed and made reference to a moment ago. And that is that we had the Civil War, which focused our attention attention as a whole people on what the Constitution meant in terms of ourselves as citizens and of a united country. And we had to decide. It all wasn't decided on the basis of armies facing each other and committing carnage on the human body. But it was really about that idea and the consequences of that war refocused, or maybe focused for the first time, the fact that we had something in common and that there were, it was this body of ideas that we were all entitled to share in. And I think that's what's missing in some places.
Pat Derian, I want to thank you for this thoughtful overview of, again, this conference that you have come to the National Humanities Center to participate in, the idea of a civil society. You've been looking at human rights in Latin America. You are a former diplomat, a writer, serve on a number of human rights boards around the world. Thank you very much for your insights. I wish you well in your work.
Thank you very much. I love being here, and they're wonderful brownies at the center.
This is Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. In just a moment, I'll tell you where to write if you'd like a cassette tape of this week's show. You've been listening to conversations about human rights and civil societies in Latin America. My guests were diplomat and activist Patricia Derian and Robert Connor, director of the National Humanities Center. Send $5 for a cassette tape of this program or $2 for a Soundings catalog. Write to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Please ask for program number 670. That's program number 670, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code 27709. Next week, music and culture in Renaissance Italy. Listen for discussion and music featuring the work of cultural historian Craig Monson of Washington University. Support for this edition of Soundings came from the Rockefeller Foundation, with additional funding from the National Endowment for the Humanities, the A.J. Fletcher Foundation, and Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Until next week, at this time on this radio station, this is Wayne Pond. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center.